Oregon's public higher education system is structured differently now from the way it was set up 2 years ago. As of the middle of this year, all the seven state universities in Oregon have their own governing boards, rather than each answering to a central board of higher education. It was first proposed at the University of Oregon, which wanted to control its own fate. U of O leaders were aware of the issues with academic programs on campus, and a recent report in the Chronicle of Higher Education underscored those issues. Jack Stripling's article from mid-September is called "An Academic Reputation at Risk. The U of Oregon's Big Brand Masks Its Fragile Standing." Jack Stripling, again, a reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education and our guest. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So you write that Oregon now fails to measure up to higher education's heavy hitters, which implies that it did once.
Right. Well, I do think the landscape has changed, and maybe one way of looking at this over time is to say that Oregon probably has not kept pace with the people that it calls its peers. And so if we look at other universities like the University of Michigan, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, places that Oregon sort of holds itself up against, those institutions have been more effective in graduating students, producing doctoral degrees. They have better student-faculty ratios, and they certainly bring in a lot more federal grants. Now, some context, to be fair, is that a lot of this has to do with Oregon's sort of academic programmatic mix. You know, not having a medical school, not having pharmacy, not having some of these cash cow programs puts it at a disadvantage when compared just by pure numbers to some of these other institutions. At the same time, these are the colleges that Oregon considers its peers, so some analysis of how it competes seems fair game, and certainly administrators at Oregon, I think, are accepting that as well.
Did Oregon make itself something of a target by the fact that it is so out there with its athletic programs, particularly football?
Well, I mean, it becomes an easy area of criticism. It's very easy to say, well, the reason we're not excelling in some of these other areas is because our focus is on football. And that's a symbolic problem for any major research institution that has a big-time athletics program. At the same, and I think it probably has contributed to the level of discord that has existed between faculty and the administration for many years. At the same time, to be fair, Oregon's athletics program is far more self-sufficient than most universities in the country. The fact that it's self-supporting, more or less, with the exception of some money that's given to academic support for athletes, sets it apart from the lion's share of major colleges in the country. So, yes, it's a symbolic issue, but substantively, an argument can be made that this is a pretty self-sufficient athletics program.
Well, just in general terms about governance at the University of Oregon itself, I mean, we've had, as you point out in the article, five presidents in 6 years, which is really fairly rapid. Is that a symptom? Is that a contributing factor? Were you able to weed those out for causation, correlation?
I think they're all separate cases, but it points to a level of dysfunction within the university that no one can really deny. I think a lot of it had to do with political back and forth between the presidents. Richard LaRiviere, as your listeners may know, made a big push for the new governance structure that gave Oregon its own board, and that ruffled some feathers in the state. And his dismissal was criticized, but not completely unexpected, because he was in some political hot water in the state. Michael Gottfredson really ran into a buzzsaw over sexual assault issues involving the basketball team, and his handling of that was widely criticized. So I do think these are sort of isolated incidents, but the one thing you can say is that they have been enormous distractions. And so for a place that really needs to buckle down and look at the systemic issues that may be putting it at a competitive disadvantage, it's been very hard to do that because it's just a constant fire drill over there. I do think that's changing from what I've discerned from people I've talked to, but 5 years of absolute turmoil.
Jack Stripling, again, senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education, wrote the article about the University of Oregon's academic reputation at risk. You can join us on the exchange with questions or comments. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The root causes do go back 25 years, as you point out. I mean, property tax limits put K-12 education almost entirely on the state to be paying for without any new revenue. So just about everything else took cuts. And while the mechanisms may be different from state to state, this has happened in a lot of states, though, hasn't it, Jack? I mean, the lack of state support?
It has. And one of the reasons that I wanted to look at Oregon as closely as we did was because of the fact that I do think that this university is really a canary in the coal mine. This is a place that was disinvested by the state before a lot of other universities in this country. And so the effects of that are easier to see than they might be elsewhere. To put a little context here, if you look back at, before Measure 5 was passed in the state of Oregon, students in the state were paying about 60% of the cost of their education. The state was covering about 60% of the cost. Now the state only covers about a quarter of the cost of the education. So students are forking over a lot more of their own money because the subsidy is not there, and we certainly see that across the country. I do think this also figures into the tactics that Oregon has employed, if you want me to talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
In terms of how they've dealt with it. There was a major push, as your listeners probably will know, to grow undergraduate education at Oregon, and to do so by reaching out of state, bringing in students from California and neighboring states who would be full-pay students. So these students tend to be wealthier. I'm not sure if they're less diverse, but they're certainly less economically diverse than the in-state residents. And they're effectively subsidizing the other students there. So this has led to a dramatic growth in undergraduate education. It's probably one of the reasons that there's so much energy on that campus. It's a young campus. It's a vibrant campus that continues to grow. At the same time, what has not grown is research education, graduate education. And these are the things, when the University of Oregon compares itself to places like Michigan, these are the things that really start to be telling, is that they haven't grown those programs at the rate to be competitive with some of these other institutions. And you could make an argument, I think you can, that the energy and focus has been on undergraduate education, and a lot of the reason that is the case is because that's where the money was, and Oregon needed money. And so I do think that priorities became defined for the university because of the economic climate.
All right, so they had to go out to get the people who could give them more dollars, and that was undergraduates, particularly ones from out of state.
Right. It's expensive to bring in graduate students.
Well, help us understand the importance of doctoral degrees and research dollars that you mentioned in the article.
Well, you know, if you're a regional public university and your job is to principally deal with undergraduate education, then none of this stuff matters. I mean, there are some great colleges across the country that do not have robust research programs. But the University of Oregon has put itself out there as the flagship university of the state and has said that research is a big part of why we exist here. We're a national university. We're even global in our reach. And so once you stake that out as the marker for why you exist, then you have a responsibility to live up to that. Now, if Oregon wants to get into a different type of business and be an undergraduate education institution and define its mission accordingly, then that'd be one thing. But up to now, they haven't. And so that means that in order to fulfill your mission, you have to be able to prioritize things like bringing in research money, graduate education, pursuing doctoral degrees. The people that they associate themselves with are institutions that are making that a huge priority.
Well, so would emphasizing graduate programs ultimately prove, you think, as lucrative if you end up getting the research grants and all that comes attached with that?
You know, there's a lot of debate about that. I don't purport to be an expert on how the business model works in that regard. I think a lot of research is thought to actually lose money, but end up being a marker of prestige. It may not show on your bottom line that you've helped cure cancer, but it's probably a good thing. and so this is a subject of greater nuance and debate than our article got into. But to be fair, it certainly would raise the profile of the university if it was thought to be more competitive in this area.
The article that Jack Stripling refers to is the one he wrote for the Chronicle of Higher Education, called "An Academic Reputation at Risk," subtitled "The U of Oregon's Big Brand Masks Its Fragile Standing." Maybe you have some opinion about that fragile standing or think it may be a little more robust than that at the University of Oregon. Let's get your thoughts at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You do start the article off with the emphasis on sports, you know, the Donald Duck-looking duck at the University of Oregon and all that stuff. I mean, this is, I mean, the image of the University of Oregon nationally certainly has risen in prominence with the prominence of the football program, which played for the national championship twice in the last 5 years. Is that evidence, you think, of a conscious decision to either to go with the money that Phil Knight through Nike has made available, or is this part of trying to attract undergraduates because it's a fun, hip place to be?
Yeah, I mean, I it depends on who you talk to about that. I think it's undeniable that one of the reasons that young people want to come to Oregon is because the football uniforms are cool and because the football team is awesome. And I certainly observed that when I visited the campus a few months ago. I actually went on a campus tour for the first time since I was a teenager. And, you know, sitting in that room with 18-year-olds or even 15-year-olds who were asked about what they knew about the university, they invariably talked about football. They invariably talked about Nike and track. This is what, you know, admissions officials refer to as the front porch of the university. It's how you get the student interested. Now, you know, it's the job of the university, once those people are interested, to say, hey, this place is about a lot more than that. And I've certainly seen Oregon try to do that. But to say it were and not part of the bait is to be naive.
Let's talk about some of the other issues that you point out in the article. 60% of faculty not eligible for tenure, which seems like a big number. What does it mean?
You know, it does seem like a big number, but it's not that uncommon a number. You know, we increasingly see major research universities and frankly, colleges of all sorts leaning on adjunct labor, which is cheaper and you know, they certainly have more flexibility if they want to downsize with non-tenured faculty. And so this is kind of, again, sort of the story of American higher education as much as anything.
Well, on the issue of faculty, I mean, the top faculty, I mean, the really big-name professors who've written big books and made some major research findings, they cost a lot. And I wonder, you talk about the canary in the coal mine for state universities, I wonder if state universities can really compete effectively for the big-name professors anymore.
Well, certainly poaching from private universities has been a longstanding issue for major research, public research universities in the country. I look back at a place like University of Wisconsin at Madison, that a number of years ago, you know, had to establish basically sort of a treasure chest to make counteroffers to faculty members who were being lured away by elite private colleges. So that's been an ongoing problem, and it's some you know, major public research universities have had to fight against.
You mentioned membership in the American Association of Universities might be at risk at the University of Oregon. What are some of the benefits of membership, and so, in other words, why should people care?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Unless you're a higher ed geek, you probably don't have any business even knowing what that association is. So, the Association of American Research Universities is a group of, I think, about 60 elite research universities in this country. And, you know, membership, I think, sends a message of certain prestige. It sends a message that you're in this elite club. You know, they occasionally come together and make public statements, take positions on issues of national import, lobby Congress on issues of national import to higher education. And I do think that in terms of faculty recruitment, if you're talking about these rock star faculty, a lot of them want to be at an AAU school, and so that gives you a chip in that game that's important.
You listed some of the cash cow programs that the University of Oregon does not have, engineering and pharmacy among them. The Oregon State University, just an hour up the road, has them. I mean, in that context, should the U of O push for something like that?
Well, I don't see that being realistic. You know, this is a state that, to its credit, has been very nervous about the duplication of programs in Oregon, and I haven't heard anything that suggests there's any political will to start those types of programs at the flagship campus. up until a few decades ago, the medical center was affiliated with the university, but that was changed statutorily. So if all that if all that hospital money was being accounted for within the university's sort of research apparatus, these numbers would look different. And I think that's an important point to drive home. But I haven't heard anything that suggests there's any political will for bringing those types of programs to the university.
We'll take a couple more minutes with Jack Stripling here, senior reporter of the Chronicle of Higher Education. We're talking about his recent article about the University of Oregon called An Academic Reputation at Risk. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Mike in Medford emails, as an alumni of U of O, graduated in 2010, I had a pretty mediocre experience. The political science department had a website from the 90s, while the business building donated by Uncle Phil Knight, had just been completed. In fact, a slew of buildings went up when many of our programs struggled. Our best professor was in constant fear of being fired for his alternative teaching methods. The other professors just put you to sleep. The majority of students came from the Bay Area, Seattle, and East Asia. It felt like the state was getting screwed for a return on in-state students. My experience at Lane Community College and Southern Oregon University was much better. Professors who cared and directed you in the right direction. No U of O courses ever had any connection to a real job. That's the perspective of Mike in Medford. What do you make of those, Jack?
Well, that's not anything that administrators at Oregon want to hear. And, you know, the data back up some of what he has said. If you look at the ratio of tenure and tenure-track faculty to students at Oregon, it's not good. Compared to their peers, they're near the bottom. And so if his experience was he didn't feel like he had access to those people, then the data support that position. In terms of spending on buildings, there are some incredibly opulent buildings that Phil Knight has helped to fund at the university, and one of them is notably called the Jock Box, where the student support center for athletes there. This football facility is, looks like something out of a futuristic film.
Including leather from Ferraris, you point out.
Yeah. And so those things get a lot of attention. But to be fair, they've also just built a $65 million science facility. So they are spending money on academic things. And I think that there's a lot riding on fundraising at the university to change this picture. The university's just started a $2 billion capital campaign, and the hope is that a lot of that money will go to academics. So far, though, a lot of it is going to athletics.
Back to the whole canary in a coal mine theory. I mean, obviously, people who might not have heard of the Chronicle of Higher Education before heard about it now in Oregon because of this article. I wonder if you have done similar articles about other universities in similar positions because of the general slide in support from the states for their own public institutions.
We have. A number of years ago, we did a big package that looked at public higher education across the country and kind of tried to trace where did the sort of value proposition for public higher education change? The thing that you hear people talk about a lot is whether a person's education at a public university is a private good or a public good. And so if we consider it a private good, then we think that the individual should pay for his or her education because they're the ones that are going to reap the most benefit. If we consider it a public good because we think having an educated citizenry is an important thing that we ought to subsidize, then that changes the complexion of our of how we prioritize this. But if you look at the numbers right now and you look at the rhetoric surrounding higher education, there's increasing evidence that people see this as a private good and that students ought to pay out of their own pockets for it.
Ah, okay. Well, we had both Oregon senators on campus at Southern Oregon University yesterday talking about ways that they could potentially reduce some of the large load financially upon students. So it's an ongoing issue that's still very much under debate across the country. In terms of reactions to the piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education, I mean, the Register Guard in Eugene came out with an editorial quickly afterward that said it's not a hit piece, but I imagine a few people might have thought it was. I wonder what the reactions have been that you've gotten a hold of.
No, I mean, to be honest with you, I haven't really heard much from the central administration about this. Anecdotally from people, I've heard that it was well received. I don't think that, let me put it to you this way. I feel pretty good about my job when I haven't heard anything. If nobody is asking for a correction and yelling at us, then that's usually pretty nice. And if nobody is calling to pat me on the back about how I got it right, that's probably pretty nice, too. Mm-hmm. I don't want college presidents and administrators to love everything we write. But at the same time, we tried to be fair. And the way we tried to be fair here was to really ground this story in verifiable data. I mean, a lot of the argument that the article makes is one that university administrators have made themselves. The University of Oregon did its own analysis of how it compared to its peer group, and some of the findings that support this story are from their own work. So they may not like the picture, but they don't necessarily disagree with it, to my mind. The other thing is that it's kind of a sticky wicket for administrators. On one hand, they want to say everything is going well and we're a really strong research university and we compete with the best of them. On the other hand, speaking to lawmakers and constituents in the state about Oregon's position sort of within the higher education firmament is to the benefit of the university as well. That's why they wanted to have this candid conversation. A lot of these documents they've produced are aimed at lawmakers to say, hey, wake up. This is really an issue.
And we had the budget chair in here just a couple of days ago to talk about those very issues, and it's an ongoing issue in the state of Oregon and will continue to be so, given the current structure of financing for higher education in the state. Jack Stripling is a senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. His article is called An Academic Reputation at Risk, The U of Oregon's Big Brand Masks Its Fragile Standing. Jack, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.